just joined the faculty at the University of Alberta. And so he's going to be telling us about some of the exciting new results that he's been producing on Black Holmers.
Thank you very much, Rob. Yes, as Rob said, we'll be talking about some of the interesting things in the merger of the simulation of binary black hole mergers. Can we use a relation around here? That's okay, I can just... Yeah.
But it's okay.
This might be dangerous. But so, thanks. Okay, so this is sort of a brief outline of what I'm going to be talking about. I'll first try to motivate a little bit why we're interested in studying binary black hole systems. Thank you. And there are a couple of motivations from my point of view. The first thing is that simulating gravitational waves is important for the upcoming generation of gravitational wave detectors. The LIGO detector is starting to detect, they're actually up and running, and they're looking for gravitational waves. I'll try to explain a little bit why it's important to understand the nature of these waves for the purposes of detection. The other thing that I'm very interested in is to understand the strong field regime of general relativity. And black holes, when they merge, they're in the highly dynamical non-linear regime of general relativity. And very little is known about the field in that regime. So by simulating them, we can perhaps understand more about the nature of general relativity. I'll also explain a little bit in why we actually have to simulate, first, both from the point of view of gravitational wave detection, and also from the perhaps the more traditional world of the simulation that we need computers to solve these equations, because it's probably impossible to get analytic solutions in the situations of interest. I'll give a brief overview of the methodology, like why it's been traditionally been so difficult to discretize them and come up with a numerical solution. And also give you a brief overview of some of the exact formalism in the system of the equations. Some of these things I might go through a little bit quickly, because traditionally this talk about here is way too long, and I don't want to go over if I can help it, and I want to get to some of the interesting results, I think. And I'm going to be talking about simulations of two different classes of initial data, the so-called quasi-circular initial data sets, and then some binary systems constructed by a scalar field collapse. I'll explain this a little bit in more detail when I get to that. Okay, so this is one of the primary reasons why we're interested in simulating black holes, and that is we want to see gravitational waves. And there's what this slide is supposed to show is just that there is a very strong push around the world to detect these things, look at the universe using the gravitational wave spectrum. And some of these things are actual observatories, if you want to call them, such as the LIGO interferometers. LISA is a planned space-based mission, hopefully. Its funding isn't in as dire straits as people think it might be at this moment, but it might get launched in a couple of years. There are these resonant bar detectors. But there are also programs to try to infer the existence of gravitational waves and the effect that they might have, for example, on the cosmic microwave background, or by looking at a pulsar timing. For example, if there's a gravitational wave that's passing between us and the pulsar, it's going to change the structure of space and time. Such that it could produce a detectable signal in the pulsar timing as the pulses arrive at Earth. This is a very schematic overview of what we hope to see when we look at the universe with gravitational waves. So here I've got the vertical axis, I've schematically sort of represented the strength of the source, and how strong, how much energy we expect various sources to emitting gravitational waves. And this is sort of roughly the frequency of these sources. So perhaps the strongest source of gravitational waves that we think we might see are the mergers of supermassive black holes, so 10 to the 6 solar masses or more. As the mass of the black holes decrease down to the possible intermediate mass black holes, several thousand or several tens of thousands of solar masses, down to solar mass black holes, the strength decreases but the frequency increases. So one thing to note also, I've labeled on this diagram, so the frequency range where each of these observatories, if you will, is expected to operate. And the thing to note is that they're not competing against each other. They're sort of looking at different ranges of source frequency. And so in some sense, they're all probing different fundamental physics or astrophysics. till we get down to some of the best, the weaker sources. We have black hole neutron star mergers, binary neutron star systems, pulsars, supernovae, extreme X-ray if you're in spiral. So that's when you have a very small compact object, could be a black hole or a neutron star spiraling into a supermassive black hole at the center of galaxies. And the neutron star binaries, white dwarf binaries. And then here, that's sort of like exotic physics, if you will, or relics from the Big Bang Flash. Now, just as a bar, put them across the entire frequency range, because we don't really have very concrete theories about what possible exotic physics might produce gravitational waves. I mean, these things, for example, cosmic strings, that's recently, you know, there's been a lot of attention redirected towards cosmic strings as possible sources of gravitational waves. And so in that case, you can come up with very particular specific estimates of effects and frequencies. But there's a, most of these things are still, at least there's no firm prediction. But what's really exciting about this, and one thing, is that gravitational waves interact very weakly with matter. And so there really is a possibility, if there was some mechanism that produced a strong amount of gravitational waves, possibly even all the way up to the Big Bang, that it could have propagated through the universe and essentially in a way that we could potentially observe it today. So this graph is just to try to give you an overhead view of perhaps all the exciting things that we might be able to learn about the universe by looking at it in gravitational waves. Let's briefly a little bit more on binary black holes specifically, because that's what I'm most interested in what this talk's about. So first of all, there's, I think most astronomers would agree that there is very strong evidence that black holes exist and that they play a very significant role in the universe. But of course, all of this evidence is essentially circumstantial. We can't see the black holes in electromagnetic waves, but we can infer their presence based on the way in which they interact with their surroundings. In particular, perhaps the two classes of black holes where there's the best evidence for are, again, the supermassive black holes, the million to billion solar mass range, that are thought to exist in the centers of most galaxies. And there's also very good evidence for stellar mass black holes, so black holes that form at the endpoint of the evolution of certain classes of massive stars. Let's go with a couple of pretty pictures here, sort of giving an example of some of this circumstantial but good evidence. And so here, one object, kind of object that's observed in the universe is active galactic nuclei. So galaxies where a lot is happening there, in particular, one of the things is that they're emitting jets of material. So they're very luminous sources of a lot of energy. And it's very difficult to explain these jets if you don't use black holes. And so the existing theory is that there's a supermassive black hole at the center of one of these galaxies, and it's spinning very rapidly. So material is falling into this black hole. It's forming an accretion disk. And then because of the rotation of the black hole, material is then getting ejected along the spin axis of this black hole. I mean, all the mechanisms are a little bit uncertain, but sort of the energetics require black holes. And so here in this example, this is in particular an interesting piece of evidence because it suggests not only are there these supermassive black holes, but they actually merge. Because if you look at this thing in the past, you can see the jets were in that direction, which implies that the black hole spin axis was in the same direction. But at some point in the past, some event happened that relatively quickly, especially on an astronomical time scale, caused these jets to essentially turn at a 90-degree angle, implying that the spin axis of the black hole changed by the same amount. And if you think about, well, one of these supermassive black holes that have a tremendous amount of angular momentum, and it doesn't take you can't, by ordinary accretion processes, change the angular momentum that rapidly. So this is implying that there was a merger with another black hole that caused the spin axis to change. Here's just another example of two galaxies that will merge perhaps a few hundred million years in the future, but you can see both of these have central jets, again implying that they're two black holes. And so one comment about gravitational waves is that black holes in isolation don't emit gravitational waves. They have to interact strongly with some other strong field source of gravity. So of course, to see black holes, we need to see the gravitational waves that they emit, but we have to see them interaction. And so it's not good enough that we think black holes might exist. They have to exist in binaries, which then merge. Then we've got a good chance of seeing them. And this is some of the background evidence that we think that they're promising sources of gravitational waves. Okay, just going to say a little bit about the two-body problem, because that's to understand the dynamics of black hole mergers and general relativity. That's really what we're talking about, the two-body problem. Just to remind you, of course, that is just the problem. You've got two massive objects that are interacting through their mutual gravity. So, of course, in Newtonian gravity, that's a relatively simple problem, and it's been solved many, many hundreds of years ago. I think that the answers are just ellipses, right? So, for example, the planets orbit around the sun in an ellipse. But when you go to general relativity, things become much more complicated. And in fact, there's no analytical solution to the two-body problem. And if you think about all the interesting phenomenology that relativity seems to impart to the two-body problem, I don't think it's unreasonable to understand that there's no analytic solution, and probably never will be. So just here for a few examples. So the way that we can understand what general relativity, how it changes this picture of an ellipse, is we can look at various limits of the theory. We can apply, for example, perturbation calculation or similar techniques. For example, one is a test particle limit. So we look at the geodesic motion of a particle about a massive black hole. So we ignore the self-gravity of the particle. And then already at that level, we start to see very interesting dynamics in the orbits. For example, at the lowest order, you get perihelion precession. If you look at things, if you start adding a significant amount of spin to the various objects, and you make them pass very close to the central black hole, you could even get sort of formally chaotic orbits. Now, if you look at another sort of perturbative expansion of the theory, for example, the post-Newtonian expansions, then you start to take into account self-gravity. But there you have to assume that they're slow motions and that they're weak gravitational fields. And at that level, you start to notice that general relativity predicts these orbits aren't stable. If you have a closed-bound orbit, it's going to radiate energy gravitational waves, and which means that the orbits are going to decay. So thanks to our understanding of the global properties of the field equations and assuming cosmic censorship, we know that the end state of one of these decays when the two black holes get close together is that they have to merge to form a single larger black hole. For example, we know that they're not going to shatter into many little black holes as they collide, and they won't just stick together to form some weird kind of complicated black hole atom. These things are going to merge to a single black hole. So this is an interesting part of the two-body problem where we know if we have bound orbits, At the end, the two-body problem is going to become a one-body problem. And one way of trying to understand a bit of the one-body problem, you can look at, for example, black hole perturbation theory, and that can tell you a little bit of how, once these objects have merged, how it's going to settle down to that one final rotating black hole. But if you look at like all of this, all of these indications of what, how interesting the two-body problem, becomes in GR, we notice that in the merger of black holes, all of the assumptions that we've made where these approximations can be used break down. For example, in a merger of near equal mass black holes, you can ignore the self-gravity. The self-gravity is strong. They're not moving slowly. They're moving at very sizable fractions of the speed of light. And the fields aren't weak. The nonlinearity of the field equations have to be taken into account. And so numerical relativity, another perhaps misnomer, is that it's going to solve the two-body problem. Well, of course it's not. It's just a little piece of the two-body problem. All of this is the two-body problem, and all of the bits of information we'll use to get to understand the nature of interactions in relativity. So let me take just a couple of minutes to explain numerical relativity and what the complications and challenges are. Of course, everyone knows these are the field equations of GR. This is the Einstein tensor. This is a stretch energy tensor of any matter fields that might be in the space-time. I'm using units where Newton's constant, the speed of light, have been set to 1. So of course, these are very deceptively simple, this form of the field equations. But of course, when we say we want to solve the field equations, we're really interested in the geometric structure of a particular, of a space-time describing some situation of interest, such as the collision of black holes, which means we want to solve for the metric element describing that geometry. So of course, if you take this, the usual form of the of writing the matrix, some kind of this line element, so GAB is a metric tensor, and you plug that into the field equations, you get a system of 10 coupled nonlinear second order partial differential equations, each one of these depending on the four space-time coordinates. And so we say in solving the field equations, we're solving those partial differential equations, and with numerical literature, we're solving it on a computer. There are a couple of slides that I've removed, but let me just say, I'm not going to go into why this has been a complicated problem, but I think you can immediately see that just having 10 coupled nonlinear equations, it might be there might be a lot of issues arising if you try to solve them numerically. So I think I'm actually going to skip some of the details of the numerics because it's, I tend to get bogged down in this part of the talk and going through all these complicated equations. And it doesn't really, it's not too important, but if anyone's really interested in the exact formulation of the field equations, then please feel free to ask me afterwards and I can describe the details. I'll just perhaps just summarize. So I use something called generalized harmonic coordinates. Well, these are the equations that I wrote. It's a full of the field equations based on generalized harmonic coordinates. I use finite difference techniques, compactified spatial infinity, etc. But those, I think those technical details are a little bit boring. So let me get towards the onto the simulation part of it. First, this is a sort of a brief and very incomplete history of binary black hole problem in numerical relativity. And it's more just to give you a sense, I don't know if so those in the relativity community, there's been a lot of excitement in the past year over the development, so I just want to give you a sense for why people are excited. And it's just because it's taken such a long time to get to where we are now. So the first simulation of the black hole merger was done in 1977 by Larry Smart for his PhD thesis. And so what he did was he restricted the situation to axis symmetry, so a head-on collision. So it's a, instead of a, in usual we'd have a 3+1 dimensional simulation, now it was a 2+1 dimensional simulation. But nevertheless, it was a heroic calculation, especially, you can imagine the kinds of computers they had in 1977. In any case, because it was such a computationally challenging problem, no one even tried to do the 3D problem. Until the early 90s, when people realized that, okay, they've been proposing to build gravitational wave detectors such as LIGO for a long time, and finally around that time, it seemed as if the funding was there and these things were really going to go ahead. And then it became much more of a push to solve this problem. Perhaps I didn't quite mention, as some of the other slides that I cut, is the reason why simulating these things is so important for detection is that I'll give an example of how weak these signals are at some point, but by the time the waves reach Earth, they're incredibly weak signals. And despite the incredible sensitivities of these detectors, it's almost, if you just look at the signals, it's going to be swamped by noise. And so you need sophisticated data analysis techniques to extract the signals from the data. And one of the most promising ways is match filtering. So if you can understand the nature of what you think you're trying to see, you can improve your signal to noise by a significant amount. But that's one of the reasons why there's been such a push in the relativity community to understand all the possible sources of gravitational waves. There are still techniques that are available to try to look for those things that we might not anticipate. But the best chance of early detection and understanding the astrophysics is to understand the nature of the waves. Sorry for that digression. I guess I should have cut slides as aggressively as I did. In any case, so then in the early 90s, there was a very strong push to solve this problem in the numerical relativity community. And so these people repeated this calculation of Smart back in 93. And then it was thought, well, okay, we've got much more powerful computers, we can just do the 3D problem. That didn't work. And I won't get into all the technical details, but it's really the mathematical complication of the field equations. People didn't quite understand the structure of the equations. And so it took about 4 years, actually. So Werner Brugmann first released these results in 1997. It was only published a couple of years later. But this was the first non-head-on collision. And so he took the black holes, escaped them a slight impact parameter, and tried to collide them. The problem is the simulation crashed almost immediately. So it didn't run for long enough to even get close to extracting the waves. And then since 97 to 2004, it's about another 7 years, that's how much effort, how much time it took to go from a little grazing to collision to essentially an orbit. But still, the simulation crashed. It didn't last long enough to extract the waves. And so I think there was a lot of depression in the field, especially since LIGO was nearing completion. This is the way that the problem was going to be solved. It's a series of these tiny little baby steps. Perhaps in 2010 we'd get two orbits, perhaps in 2015 we'd actually get something that might be useful for gravitational waves. And so it was kind of depressing. But I think then with some of the progress that's been made over the last year, we've really overcome that hurdle of the codes crashing. So now we can actually evolve these things for long enough to extract waves. I mean, these early simulations, they're not very accurate, and they still require a tremendous amount of supercomputer power. So it's going to take a few years to actually explore the landscape of binary mergers. But at least now we can do this, and it seems like we've overcome. Things aren't going to be proceeding with our baby steps anymore. We can actually look at what people thought in 1993 that they would be able to do. Okay, so before I describe the simulation, let me just make a comment on the initial data. So by initial data, we're going to be considering these to be sort of Cauchy simulations, which apply some initial approximation to the geometry, which is potentially an exact solution to the field equations, but it's going to be an approximation to the astrophysical scenario. And then we're going to be evolving that forwards in time. So at present, it's a very difficult problem to specify astrophysically realistic initial data. And primarily because if you think of because of the computational challenges of solving these things, we can't start the black holes too far apart. We have to start them pretty close together so that they're only going to orbit for a few times before merging. That already takes weeks of computer simulation time. But there's no method currently available that can actually put in the correct astrophysical initial data, which if you think about it, say these black holes started very, very far apart. They've been spiraling in for thousands of orbits. And at this point, when we're going to start the numerical simulation, then the entire in-spiral history should be present in the initial data. There's a whole range of waves that are outgoing that should be part of the initial data. And there's no way of currently doing that. And so in the animation that I'll show you, and I'll point this out, they don't put in any initial data, and actually what's even worse, they're sort of junk initial radiation. But luckily that radiation leaves the domain pretty quickly. It doesn't seem to affect the subsequent dynamics. So I'm not going to go into any more details about this, but this is really a complicated problem, and perhaps it'll be several years, I think, before there are proper prescriptions for doing that. So I'm going to show you some examples from the evolution of two classes of initial data. The first one is perhaps a better approximation to astrophysically relevant initial data. And the next one is going to be more of the initial data to explore some of the perhaps more theoretically interesting regions of binary black hole mergers. So this so-called quasi-circular in-spiral initial data set provided by Harold Pfeiffer, his work that he did with Greg Cook. And this is supposed to be the approximation of an equal mass co-rotating system of black holes that spiral in from a very large distance. But of course, again, I said we're going to start these simulations when they're very close to each other. So we're missing there's no initial gravitational radiation content. So it's a pretty good approximation to the system. I gave this talk a couple of days ago at the APS, and Greg Cook was there and said, no, they actually do have tidal deformation. So perhaps I should modify that it's not that there is no tidal deformation in the initial data, but they're not quite sure they've got the correct tidal deformation. Because these black holes, when they're very far apart, they're going to be like swashbuckling black holes. But when they get very close to each other, the gravity is going to distort them in some fashion. And then the quasi-circular part of this approximation is when they assume that the black holes are initially on exactly a circular orbit. But of course, if you think of it, these black holes are actually on the spiral. So if you look at them at any one time, there should be a little bit of a radial component to the velocity, and that's not present in the initial data. So one thing is that there's a whole series of data sets, and that's parameterized by the initial separation. But at the end of the day, there's all supposed to be approximations to just a single astrophysical scenario. That's an equal mass and a merger where the black holes weren't rotating initially. So on this plot, I'm showing, to give you a demonstration of the resulting orbits, I'm showing you the centers of the apparent horizons, which are full approximations to the event horizon, as these two black holes spiral in. So this is a slice of the orbital plane. Initially, the two black holes are over there. This one is given a velocity in this direction, this one in that direction. The little dashed blue circle is the shape of the apparent horizon in coordinate space on this initial plane. You can see that in this, with this particular separation, it goes through about 2.5 orbits. At the points where these green lines vanish is where at the first encompassing horizon has been detected. And so, if you will, that's the time of coalescence. So just before that point, those two sort of pinkish lines show the shapes of the apparent horizon of the individual black holes. So you can see how much more distorted they've become. By the way, the chain, the fact that they look larger than this one, that's just a coordinate effect. In fact, very soon after this, after these things evolve, they actually expand a little bit. So they've got close to the same area, but the fact that they're on a different side is just a coordinate effect. This sort of red dashed circle is the shape of the initial encompassing horizon. So you can see it's a very distorted shape. So it's not even close to a curved black hole. But within a little while, this thing will settle down, it will ring down to a curved black hole. And that's the shape of the curved horizon is this dashed, whatever that color line is. And so in a curved black hole, it's an oblate shape, but in the equatorial plane, it's a circle. So the parameters for this merge system, so this is the initial separation. Of course, in relativity, there's always the confusion about slicings and coordinates. I've written you down what the coordinate separation is, proper separation on this particular time slice is. The final black hole that forms has an angular momentum of about 0.7 times the mass squared. So recall from the curved black hole that the maximum mass that a rotating black hole can have is J equals 1 times N squared. So this is about 70% of the maximal possible rotation for a black hole. So it's quite a significant amount of angular momentum.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you remember how much initial angular momentum goes?
I don't know. I don't recall off the top of my head. Yeah. Three to four, something like that, in units of M squared. But yeah, that wouldn't record me on that. And so the other thing is the reason they're spiraling in is, of course, because they're losing energy from gravitational radiation. And the estimate in this case, they emitted about 4.3% of the energy in gravitational waves. And just to show you the kinds of computer I needed to do the simulations, I did several resolutions, but the highest resolution, which took the longest, took about 60,000 CPU hours. So if you could run, so I ran on typically 128 processors in a parallel cluster, and that would be about 3 weeks of runtime. I mean, in practice, it took about 2 months because you can't submit jobs for more than a day in the queue in this one. So you have to stop them, and et cetera. It's a bit of a mess. But so you can just give you an idea of the amount of computer power it takes to do these things. Here's an animation of one of the functions of this merger. It's called the lapse function. And again, going through a slicing through on the orbital plane of a simulation. The lapse function just measures the proper time of an observer that's sitting at a particular point on the grid relative to infinity. So someone at infinity will measure the rate of change of time of 1. And in this kind of, in this coordinate system, and as you approach the black hole, there's sort of a time dilation effect, which is what this function is showing. Just one comment. This is what's called the excision surface, technically. And it's a little bit inside the apparent horizon. The apparent horizon that I've drawn out, the one's a little bit outside these two excision surfaces. And the excision surface jumps around a little bit, but the idea is that it's always inside the apparent horizon. And that's because we have to eliminate the geometric singularities that occur inside the black holes. And as long as we do it inside the apparent horizon and if cosmic censorship holds, causality will protect any kind of stuff that we do inside it from polluting the exterior part of the domain, which is what we're interested in for gravitational waves. You see that initially they start on their So this is sort of showing you a plot of the orbital plot, but now one of the actual metric functions. Speed up slightly, and eventually they'll merge or form a rather distorted black hole, but rather quickly it will settle down to the current black hole. So like about 10 seconds of animation for 60,000 hours of computer time. So here I'm going to show a simulation of the Neeman-Penrose scalar from that same simulation. I'm going to show sort of an oblique view. And the Neeman-Penrose scalar actually diverges as you approach a black hole, so I just cut it off for visualization purposes. So it's not that there are actually four little black holes there, that's just where I happen to truncate the function. So what the Neeman-Penrose scalar is at least far from the sources, it's a measurement of the gravitational radiation, and specifically the second time derivative of the psi 4. It's a complex quantity. So the real and the imaginary components are just the plus and the cross polarizations of the gravitational wave. And this quantity is just much easier to calculate than the usual gravitational wave strain, if you've seen talks from LIGO, things like that. Let me show you. So you can see initially there was no radiation. There are these two little bursts of radiation, which is called junk radiation. It's not really part of the actual what we would consider astrophysically relevant. But now here you can see what the kinds of waves that the orbital motion is producing. At this time, it's now merged into a single black hole. And this highly distorted black hole, as it settles down to a curved black hole, that emits gravitational waves. And again, this stuff, the spiky nature, is just a visualization artifact. So on this figure to the right here, I'm just taking the same data and extract sort of integrating over a sphere and taking the dominant spherical harmonic component of it wave, just to give you a nicer sort of plot of what the wave, the radiation might look like. And a distance of about 50 m from the source. And by the way, I've scaled all units to the mass of the total mass of the system, so the sum of the rest masses of the black holes. That's just a convenient unit to use here. So you can see initially there's no radiation. Then there's this burst of initial data junk stuff. Then you start to get the orbital, the waves from the orbital motion. And interestingly, at about this point is where they actually merge. So after there's a common horizon, the amplitude increases for a while before you get the ring downs. It settles down to a curved black hole. So just going back to real units, taking away the M, just to give you sort of a sense for what this might represent. So let's scale this merger up to as if it were 2 10 solar mass black holes. In that case, so the total mass of each black hole is about 2 × 10⁻³ kilograms. The spherical radius of these black holes is about 30 kilometers there. And by the way, so I've chosen this 10 solar mass thing because that is one of the most promising ranges in LIGO's frequency band. So the most promising initial binary black hole that they might detect would be a 2 10 solar mass in that range black hole system. The radius of the final black hole would be about 60 kilometers. Where I've measured this wave, so where I've produced this plot is a distance of 50 times n, which translates into 1500 kilometers from this merger event. In these units, then, the frequency of the in spiral, so initially it's at about 200 hertz in the wave-like motion, and then it increases the frequency in the ring down to about 800 hertz. So interestingly, these are in the audio band, so you could actually play one of these, and I didn't make a little sound file of this, but the thing is, it only lasted for several waves, so it would be like a 20th of a second, so you wouldn't hear much. So what these gravitational waves are, they're like oscillatory distortions in the geometry of space-time. And at this particular distance from the source, the fractional distortion at the maximum amplitude is about 3 × 10⁻³. So for example, if you're about 2 meters tall and you're actually standing there, you'd be stretched and squeezed as this wave passes, and the maximum distortion would be about 6 millimeters. So not too much, you might even survive that, especially since it's only going to be a couple of bursts at that maximum amplitude. So LIGO is an interferometer that's designed to measure the stretching and squeezing, and it's an arm length of 4 kilometers. So that LIGO's arm length will change by about 12 meters in total, which is a huge change. But the most promising location where we might see these black holes is in the Virgo cluster. And that's at about 10 megaparsecs away. Now, the amplitude of this wave decays as 1 arc from the distance of the source. And so if you say, like, what is this 12 meters by the time that it gets to LIGO? It's 5 × 10⁻¹⁷ meters. So 1/20th the radius of the proton. That's an incredibly small distance that LIGO is trying to measure. But the astonishing thing is that this is well within the ballpark of what they can measure. I mean, they claim that they can do something like 1,000th the radius of the proton. I mean, don't believe me, I don't believe them, but they actually have seen the noise curves at the recent ACE meeting, and they're actually down to the sensitivity. It's just remarkable. So the other thing that's interesting about these numbers is that this is a very, very small distortion in space-time, especially by the time it gets to Earth, or even very close to the black hole. But remember, about 4% of the total energy was radiated. And this is, so it's about 20 solar masses of energy. About a whole solar mass equals mc squared was converted to gravitational energy and radiated a fraction of a second. And so at this peak amplitude, that's about 100 Planck velocity. I mean, this is incredible amounts of energy, and yet it's not doing too much to space-time. So I mean, that's telling that space-time is very rigid. It takes a lot of energy to distort it. And luckily for us, that distortion doesn't interact very strongly with matter, because there's something emitting energy at that rate, that could be disastrous. But okay, so the last couple of simulation stuff I want to show you is now sort of going away from something which might be astrophysically interesting. I mean, these, what I'll show you now might be of astrophysical evidence, but what I'm really wanting to do here is explore some of the interesting dynamics that might happen in the strong field regime when two black holes interact. And so, sort of an easy way to set up a binary to do this is to use scalar field collapse. So, I take two very dense distributions of scalar field energy and boost them. Essentially, I separate them by a distance and boost them in opposite directions. So, initially, there are no black holes in my space-time. But because I make these scalar fields so dense, very quickly afterwards, they collapse down to form black holes. And then there's some remnant scalar field that doesn't form into the black holes, but sort of like the junk radiation I showed you in the previous slide, that remnant scalar field just radiates away, and it doesn't dynamically affect the system afterwards. So these sort of scalar fields are just a vehicle such that a little while later, once the scalar field has left the domain, I'm left with essentially one of two vacuum black holes. So in this first set of experiments that have been, numerical experiments that I've been doing with this kind of initial data, is I take equal mass non-rotating distributions of scalar fields. So they're going to form equal mass non-rotating black holes. And I use one parameter, the boost parameter. I boost one in one direction, the other one, the same boost parameter in the other direction, and vary that parameter. So you can think that there are two uninteresting limits, if you will. First of all, if they zero boost, they're just going to collapse, and it's going to be a head-on collision, which isn't too interesting in some sense. And the other limit, if I give them very large boost velocities, they're just going to fly apart. There's going to be some deflection, but there isn't going to be anything interesting that happens other than that. So there's going to be some intermediate range of this boost parameter where interesting things might happen. So we're going to explore what could possibly happen in that case. And so, again, if you want to try to relate this to an astrophysical system, these binaries are genetically going to have some eccentricity, quite a bit of eccentricity. They might, in fact, even be unbound orbits. I haven't quite analyzed. I figured that out in too much detail yet. So it's arguable whether such kind of binary configurations exist in the universe. But still, it allows us to explore these things in relativity. I just want to show you one example of the scalar field profile. And I just want to show you this in the coordinates that I use in the code. So I actually compactify the spatial infinity. So these boundaries are actually spatial infinity. In this part, I'm showing you the magnitude of the scalar field, and the color coding is sort of redundant for that logarithmic plot. So you can see the other two pulses of scalar field in the orbital plane. I'll play the animation. So you can see they very quickly collapse. There's two little black holes. Little black holes spiral around and merge and form a single black hole. And it's the curious thing, but because of the compactification, these are really spherical waves as far from the source, but the compactification makes them look squared. But the one thing to note is that very quickly, so at this time, essentially all of the scalar field that didn't go into the black holes left the domain. And it's a pretty good approximation to what you get for a vacuum binary black hole system. Here's an example, like the similar plot of the kinds of orbits that you get. So I've now adjusted that boost parameter to get a couple of interesting orbits before merger. So the first thing that you can see that there must be more eccentricity than in the quasi-circular in-spiral case, because actually it becomes a relatively tight configuration quite quickly. But again, qualitatively, it's a similar kind of behavior, right? You get the, and one thing you can notice is that the curve doesn't start exactly at zero, so it's taken that amount of time for the scalar field to collapse. And I only start going to the spot once I detected black holes. But again, you get a very distorted curve black hole, eventually settles down to a stationary curve black hole. So this is a very, very busy plot, but it's showing some of the interesting, tentative indications of kind of interesting behavior that I'm starting to see. And there's a lot to explain, so let me just focus on this part of it. So the one warning is that with numerical simulations, if you want to be sure that you're solving the underlying equations, you have to run things at several resolutions and do convergence testing. So why I like showing you tables from three different resolutions is to show you have almost no data at the highest resolution, very little data at the low resolution. And so these results are very tentative. I can do, you know, very systematic convergence testing. So I'll just focus on this one part where I have the most data. So here I've got the boost parameter. And so I'm very varied it from this is increasing down here. And what I'm showing is above this line are all the cases that in the time of the simulation merge to form a black hole. And here I'm plotting, for example, what the final mass was, units of initial mass, what the final angular momentum was, and how much energy was radiated. So in particular, you can see as I increase, so this would be the limit as V goes to zero of the head-on collision, so that would be zero orbits. Here I'm plotting the number of orbits before merger. So as I increase the boost parameter, I'm giving them more tangential, more angular momentum, if you will. They orbit around a bit more before merging, radiate more energy, etc. Below this line, in the length of the time of the simulation, they actually don't form, they don't collide to form a single black hole. So what they do is that they'll orbit a little bit around and then they'll move apart again. So the interesting note, though, is there seems to be this sort of bifurcation point here in parameter space. Look, for example, these two cases, the initial boost parameter differs by less than a part from 10 to the 5. And yet the qualitative behavior is, you know, apples and oranges different. This one case merges in 3.7 orbits. This other case whirls around a lot and then separates again. So it seems that there's this region of parameter space where there's exponential sensitivity to the initial data, and that you change the initial parameter of the orbit by just a very tiny bit, and you get very different behavior at the end of the day. So I'm still not 100% sure exactly what this is, or if it is just too much numerical error. But at least one explanation seems to be that this is sort of the fully nonlinear analog of the so-called zoom whirl orbits for a test particle in Schwarzschild. But by the way, so here are a couple of examples. So here I'm showing like a similar example of the orbital plots as the previous one. I'm not showing the shapes of the apparent horizons. I'm only showing you one of the black holes. So you can flip this graph around. But the other black hole is in flight. So these are examples of these two different boost parameters. So initially the orbits traced out exactly the same shape. But at one point, there's one case that continues to whirl around a bit and then separates. With the other one, it actually plunges together to form a black hole. There are just a couple of comments. So the reason that this goes out further than the starting point is most likely numerical error. The other possibility is that there's something strange going on with the initial data, and this is actually an unbound orbit. So this might actually be a hyperbolic orbit. It's very difficult to really, these look very simple, these diagrams, but remember, this is in the strong field regime. They're very, very close to each other. And I'm plotting things in coordinate space, which can be very different from proper metric space. And it's kind of difficult to disentangle things, and I'm still in the process of doing that. But curious, but this kind of behavior is very similar to what you get if you look at a test particle orbiting a schwarzschild black hole, it eclipses. And if you look at a test particle in a schwarzschild black hole, and you look at the, at least on the equatorial plane, it orbits in an effective potential of a shape of something like this, for example. And there's this orbit called the homoclinic orbit, where if, it's, if the potential is exactly at this point, so this is the innermost stable circular orbit, or this is an innermost stable circular orbit, and in one of these homoclinic orbits, the particle starts at some large distance, it gets close to the black hole, stays there for a bit, and moves back. But what happens is when it's very close to the black hole, if you will, there's a lot of perihelion precession. And so it stays out here, it goes around, it whirls around for very, very many times, and then it moves out again. And it's called one of these zoom well orbits. So it zooms out to a distance, it goes in and whirls around. And so it seems as if we're getting the fully nonlinear equivalent of this. But there are a couple of puzzling or interesting things here. And one is the distance, the coordinate distance where this seems to be happening is at about 3m, which is, in the test particle case, corresponds to the innermost stable photon orbit. So these things are, they're perhaps 20% the speed of light, but still, they seem to be going to innermost stable photon orbit, which is kind of interesting. And the other thing that's surprising is that this is in the test particle limit is an unstable one. So if, I mean, a tiny perturbation will push it one way or the other. But in this, say take for example this blue case. So here now it's going, it's now starting to approach very close to that point, but it's orbiting a couple of times. So if this is an unstable point, each time it's orbiting, it's radiating a tremendous amount of energy, which you'd think would be a large perturbation. And that just the fact that it's gone around once and lost so much energy would change the orbit. But we're still seeing that it goes around for perhaps 2-3 more times before it moves out. So it's kind of, at least the classical explanation for what this might be, it's a bit strange that you can get such kind of behavior given that it's supposed to be an unstable orbit. But again, I mean, I'm more just speculating what this might be. I'm not really claiming that. It's still going to take a lot of work and more simulations to be convinced that this is what's happening. So let me just show you a couple of animations. Here again is a lapse function from a case that went to an object and then merged. So it's very similar to the previous one, except they get quite a bit closer. So they orbit a little bit faster. Then again, it forms a rather distorted black hole that eventually rings down to a curved black hole. There are a couple of jitters in the animation. Some of it is I've missed a few frames, lost a few frames, and then again the excision surface does change around a little bit as it goes. This one is now the Neumann-Penrose scalar again, so one of the component polarizations of the wave. See, initially there's junk radiation. There's a little bit more junk radiation that's associated with the scalar field. And as they get close, you start seeing the orbital motion. And the amplitude here is actually quite a bit higher than the quasi-circular case. And then again, it merges, you get a bit of a ring up and then a ring down as it sails down to a curved black hole. And then this, you get eventually numerical errors accumulate. But this is a logarithmic scale again, so it's essentially, if you're looking at part in the 100 or 1,000 down to a near vacuum situation, or sorry, close to a curved black hole. Here is, again, a plot of those waves. And here I've shown now both polarizations. This would be the cross polarization and the plus polarization, and vice versa. But again, this illustrates that if you were just looking at this system from the distance, you don't actually look at the near field geometry, like, for example, what LIGO would see. You know, things that differ almost by about a part in 100,000. And so you'd expect that the waveforms would differ by a similar quantity, but because of this apparent exponential sensitivity, you really get a macroscopic different waveform at the end of the day. So one question is, okay, say this is real, this is a simulation of something that actually is happening, it's not all numerical error. How far can this go? So in other words, if I tune that parameter V to infinite precision, how many orbits can I get? Because this system is losing energy. It loses about 1% of its total mass per orbit in this whirl stage. So I mean, reasonably, it's only got a finite amount of energy that it can radiate. So we can use the area theorem to try and give us an estimate. So Hawking's area theorem says that essentially if you assume cosmic censorship and reasonable forms are better, and then the sum, the net area of all black holes in the universe cannot be decreased with time. It's got to stay the same or increase. So this is the expression for the area of an isolated rotating black hole. This is its mass, this is its angular momentum. And so we can calculate that at the initial slice. So initially the two black holes aren't rotating, so J is zero. And in these units where M is the total mass of the space-time, each black hole is a mass M over 2. So before the black holes merge, we have the total area in the space-time at this quantity, 8 pi m squared. So what this is saying is that once these black holes merge, the final area of that curved black hole has to be greater than or equal to the area of the area of the initial black hole. So if you look a little bit at this expression, you can see that the maximum amount of energy that you can extract from the system, and if cosmic censorship holds, and you always have black holes, is if the final black hole is not rotating. So it's a Schwarzschild black hole again with J equals zero. And so if you apply this inequality, you find that that 16 pi the final mass has to be greater than 8 pi the initial total mass. And so the difference between the initial and final masses is a bound of the energy that's going to be radiated. In this case, it's 29%. So if you look at the early results, it seems to be that regardless of how many times they orbit, they seem to have a spin of about 0.7 once they merge. Let's assume that trend occurs. So if there is some angular momentum in the final black hole, well, that doesn't change things by too much. It still says that you can get theoretically as much as 24%. Of the energy, but it has radiation. So if that's the case then, and we assume that the same trend continues, that we're losing about 1% per orbit, we might be able to get about 20 to 30 orbits at threshold as we do this fine-tuning process, which I think that's pretty interesting. Even though this might not be actually physically relevant, because of course these kinds of orbits might not naturally be produced in binaries, and second of all, there's not going to be a natural fine-tuning mechanism that chooses that very particular value of the impact parameter. And so I think it's interesting if there could be a situation where essentially generically there's some region of parameter space where you can extract the maximum theoretical possible energy from these things before they merge. Okay, so just summarizing again. So I think the next 5-10 years is going to be a really exciting time in astrophysics. If these gravitational wave detectors work as we think they are, and they allow us to see the universe in this entirely new gravitational wave spectrum. I mean, history has sort of shown us whenever a new part of the electromagnetic spectrum has opened our eyes to the universe. I mean, there have been certain expected sources, but in many cases, there have been complete surprises. And so this is now going to be an entirely new way of looking at the universe. And so I think it's going to be very exciting. Even if all we do is see what we expect to see or don't see anything, which would be perhaps a bit scary, but it might just tell us that relativity is wrong. I think it's going to be really exciting. And of course, in the specific part of this that I'm interested in, which is a numerical simulation of black holes, I think it's also going to be a very interesting time, both for the sake of trying to help the gravitational wave detection efforts, but also just to try to understand general relativity in this very interesting strong field regime. And so just but these first simulations, so far we haven't really seen anything wild. So I don't know if you've been at any of Kip Thorne's talks several years ago, and they're saying what might happen. You know, he shows you these in spiral signals which you get from post-Newtonian, and then he draws this ring down signal and says, well, we don't know what's happening in this regime. It could be something like that, you know. Well, okay, we haven't seen anything wild like that. It just seems to be about as simple as a kind of extrapolation, except perhaps that we see a bit of a ring. But the comment is, so far, the only simulations that people have really looked at are equal mass, zero eccentricity orbits. And only recently has one group looked at, so there have been some work on unequal mass cases, which I expect to get kicks, but recently also another group has looked at situations where the spins, black holes have a significant amount of spin, and the difference between aligned and anti-aligned spin. But even that's supposed to be a relatively boring case. For example, that example of the test particle orbits where there were these chaotic orbits, it requires that they have spin, and that the spins not be aligned with the orbital angular momentum. Mm-hmm. Then you get all these perihelion precession, but you also get precession of the orbital plane, And so we haven't seen anything too wild, but then we've only just barely scratched the surface, I think. And in particular, I think gives us tentative indication that even the Zoom world-like behavior survives when you turn on, when you look at the full theory. I think there's going to be a lot of interesting things that we're going to uncover about black hole coalescence in the next few years. So thank you very much.
So Rob had to leave to attend to the family situation, so I'll be chairing the rest of the session. So are there any questions for Franz?
A couple of questions. Why is it so difficult to go away from the equal mass space? And the second is there some analytic example one can get on perturbation theory, say if you have a few solar mass black holes in orbit around a black mass black hole? Just for fun.
Around a black mass black hole? The extreme mass ratio case. So I'll answer your questions in reverse. Yeah, so with extreme measures, in case there are all of these perturbative methods that work. I guess Eric is probably the expert, and he can explain all those things to you. But it's not really a solved problem. So the one thing is, the first approximation is the geodesic motion. From the geodesic motion, you can estimate the energy radiator, say, with a quadrupole formula, which is pretty good. But then to get the cell forcing, the back reaction, that's a bit more difficult, but people are starting to get a handle on that. And I think that's one of the cases where it's completely unrealistic to assume that numerical simulation techniques can handle that into the full problem because of the extreme ratio of length scales that you have to resolve. And so if you will, that's the reason. So unequal masses, the problem right now is again the length scale. So say you've got a black hole that's that large and one that's that small. So to do something like this, you have to resolve both of these length scales. And so you can do that, like adaptive mesh refinement, but it's going to be a much more computationally intensive problem. And the more extreme the mass ratio, the worse the problem becomes, because in some sense, the smallest length scale and the shortest time scale you have to resolve is that of the smallest object. And so, say, if you think of like something that's that small, as it makes an orbit, the time of this thing, it's just one orbit, but this thing has undergone a tremendous amount of dynamics relative to the local length scales. So it just becomes a computational thing. So I think it probably wouldn't be unreasonable to expect numerical, full non-linear numerical techniques to handle perhaps 10 to 1, even 20 to 1 mass ratios. But if you want to go much more than that, it's not going to be, you have to use these perturbative techniques. But then again, the more extreme the mass ratio is, I think the more accurate they're going to be, and so you don't really need numerical techniques in the extreme limit.
So given the sensitivity of various detectors and the numbers which you gave us in simulations for frequencies of these various phases, will you be able to see all the phases, like bring down phase and then this central phase on experiments?
Yeah, so it depends on the masses of the black holes and which detectors. So for example, the LIGO detectors are going to be sensitive, I think, in the 40, 50 hertz to 2,000 hertz range. So with this 10 solar mass case, the LIGO should see the last several hundred orbits in spiral and bring down. So it'll essentially see the whole event. If you're looking, as you increase the masses, you decrease the frequency. And so in that case, you'll start to see less and less of the in-spiral. You might see the merge and the ring down. As you decrease the masses, you're increasing the frequency, and then it might move out of LIGO's band. So, but LIGO has sort of been designed specifically to see the stellar mass black hole population.
How often will it happen?
So I don't know, in astronomical measurements, that's very quote like in the number per Milky Way equivalent galaxy per giga year or something like that. But so for LIGO at least, this initial design sensitivity, it's going to see everything at least up to the Virgo cluster, which is about, I think, 100, on the order of 100 Milky Way equivalent galaxies. And they think if the optimistic event rate is 1 per year, so they're not too confident of seeing anything with initial LIGO. But the original design specifications is what they're calling advanced LIGO 2B. They decided, just for practical reasons, to do it in a couple of steps because of the engineering challenges. And I think advanced LIGO is going to increase the radius by about 10. And the important thing is then the volume of the universe that you're actually seeing, and that's going to be at least a factor of 100 or 1,000 times more galaxies that you're going to be including. I think then the event rates, even the pessimistic ones, is that they should see several at least. And the optimistic ones are a couple per month or something. So.
Maybe I'll permit myself one. So it used to be an open issue up until, I guess, this last paper that you quote on your slide about. Mm-hmm. My question is, probably you'll explore this for you too, but the issue was, how do you start with a binary system with a lot of angular momentum and make sure that enough angular momentum is radiated away so that you still form a curved black hole?
Yeah.
In the end, it used to be thought, I mean, if you go back with the entropy calculations, you can convince yourself that there's a chance that you might end up with too much angular momentum in the core of your space-time and perhaps have a mechanism by which you would not form a curved black hole. And those people, interestingly, have found a mechanism by which you actually stay on the motion longer than you would have thought to evacuate all of this angular momentum. And it seems to me that this is a very interesting dynamic condition to explore. Are you planning to look at that?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, just too many things to do, too little time. But when I get the time, I'll start thinking. So it's really what they found is that they started. So the idea is you're like, a black hole, the maximum angular momentum a black hole can have is 1 times m squared. If you write down the curve solution, well, you can always put numbers greater than 1, but then you don't you lose your event horizon. It becomes a naked singularity. So one of the questions is, if you start with equal mass black holes, and they lose some angular momentum, and when they finally merge, they've got 70% of the maximum. But now suppose you give them a lot of spin, such that the spin is the same as the orbital angular momentum. If it followed the same trajectory as the equal mass case, by the time they get close, there'd be too much angular momentum. You wouldn't be able to form a curved black hole. And so that's been the question, okay, what happens? Do you get a naked singularity? The perturbation theory calculation suggested that there's sort of an effective repulsor force that keeps them from merging until they've radiated enough angular momentum so that they can still form a curved black hole. And this initial simulation, they looked at just 2 cases with the initial values of 0.75, like one case like this, one case opposite the orbital angular momentum. The case that was opposite the orbital angular momentum, it merged in 1 orbit. And the case where it was aligned, it took 3 orbits. So that sort of suggests that in the Fulmonian case, what seems to be happening is that it is an effective repulsive force that keeps them from merging until they've lost enough angular momentum to form a curved black hole and not a naked singularity. Which is, I don't know which would be the more interesting result.
Any other questions? Okay, so let's thank Franz again for.